Today's Teisho is on case 13 in the Heikigan Roku, the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Engo's introduction, case 13 is entitled Hario's Snow in the Silver Bowl. Engo's introduction, clouds gather over the Great Plain, but the universe can still be discerned. Snow covers the flowering reeds, and it is difficult to distinguish them. Speaking of the coldness of it, it is colder than frozen snow. As for the fineness, it is finer than powdered rice. With regard to the deepness, even the Buddha's eyes cannot penetrate it, while as for the way it is hidden, devils would be unable to spy it out. I allow you are clever enough to know three corners from one, but how would you speak to shut the mouths of people of the world? Who has the capacity to do that? See the following. Main subject, a monk asked Hario, what is the Daiba school? Hario said, snow in the silver bowl. Secho's verse, remarkable, the old man of Shinkei Temple. It is well said that snow in the silver bowl. The 96 cannot learn for themselves what it means if they cannot let them ask the moon in the sky. Daiba school, Daiba school, scarlet banners flapping, the wind is cool. Everybody for making an excellent effort. Everybody did a wonderful job this morning and last night. You know, this is the first day is generally the day when people are starting to detach themselves from their concerns outside of the Zendo. So, you know, on day one of Sesshin, you might be thinking of something you left unattended at work or some issue at home, and on day two of Sesshin, that begins to go away, and then it's hard to say where you are, but you know this is a challenging day. We're lucky that the heat dissipated a little bit, although it's going to get hot again this afternoon. But the cool air this morning was really refreshing, Basically, the truth is, whether it was hot or not, day two is a challenging day. You know, your legs get tired. You're probably experiencing some physical discomfort. And fatigue, you know, by the end of the second day, fatigue sets in. So, this is all part of a process. You know, Sesshin is really a process, and each day has a little different character. You know, so as I said, day one is, you know, people are still sort of half with one foot in Sesshin and the other foot is in their worlds outside of Sesshin. Day two is where, you know, beginning to get tired. And day three, sometime around day three, is where usually there's a kind of transition that happens where people begin to enter deeper consciousness in a profound way. If you sit regularly, you may have sits where you feel you're in a very deep place. You know, so if you're a regular sitter and you try to maintain a practice, You may sit down on the cushion someday and just think you're in heaven. And then, you know, when you come to Sesshin on day one and day two, that state of mind can seem very far away. It's like, how come my sitting was better when I was at home? But actually, there's no comparison. I mean, when you're at Sesshin, you're entering your big mind in a really profound, sustained way. You know, this is incomparable, in my opinion, this kind of practice, even though it's very challenging. You know, you're putting your whole body on the cushion. You're using your whole body to go through this process. You know, and we're doing it for 8 or 9 hours a day, so it's quite serious and quite demanding, I admit. But around day three, sometime on day three, you know, things are going. You're going to enter in a very profound way your deeper awareness. And so people who haven't been through this process don't know that mind is waiting there for them. And even people who have been through the process sort of forget about it, you know. It's like my first sesshin, I had done very little actual sitting. I had been sitting at the University of Washington, where Genki Roshi was holding a sit every Wednesday night. And I had been going for maybe a month or two, and I was somebody asked me if I wanted to go to sesshin. And I said, sure, what's a sesshin? And the person who asked me that was this very beautiful Japanese-American woman, Wendy Nakao, who has for many years been the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center, but she was at that time Genki Roshi's student in Seattle. And I had absolutely no preparation for sesshin. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And I have to say, many times, you know, my legs really hurt. You know, in fact, when I would go into Dokusan, I was sort of like crawling into Dokusan. And it just seemed like there was no posture on earth that was comfortable. I'm so glad I stayed, however, because sometime toward the end of the sesshin, you know, I wasn't fully aware of it, but I definitely entered a deeper state of concentration. And when I came back from my sesshin, I was still very much in that state of concentration. I know that somebody said, well, what was it like to be at sesshin? And I just froze. I had no way of even answering that question. I didn't say, oh, my legs hurt a lot. It was just like my mind went blank. And then later, you know, I was teaching a class. It was a remedial English class. And I raced to my class, and I got up and I started talking, and my mind just went totally blank. You know, it was like I didn't know, you know, what I was supposed to be doing next, and my mind was just totally blank. And I sort of faked it. You know, I said to my students, well, you know, I just started a conversation with them so they wouldn't think I was crazy or something. But, you know, that blank mind, I did definitely reach, even on my first sesshin, that blank mind, that unthinking, unmoving mind. And I remember, you know, basically coming home and that sort of still being in that place, right? Took me a little while to get out of it. And then it came back sort of inadvertently when I was teaching my class. Something about that experience was so amazing and unique, even though I didn't think this is amazing and unique. Something about it brought me back to the next sesshin. I didn't really think it through. You know, I wasn't really acting from a place of like conscious decision making. I knew that I had a lot to do, right? I was a graduate student. I was trying to write my graduate papers. I was trying to teach my students and finish my own grading. And so, you know, doing Zen and going to Sesshin was, you know, that was very time consuming. And it didn't, if I sat down and thought about it, it wouldn't have made much sense. But there was something about the experience that just drew me, right? That was, you know, almost like unquestioned, right? It was just something I had to do. You know, we don't necessarily always trust our intuition, you know, but I'm so glad I did, because it was almost like an unstated, I had a sort of like unstated imperative, I had to do this, right? And I don't think I ever said, no, I must do this, I just did it. And yet, you know, I think that's somewhat common with people who begin to do this. You know, without fully understanding why or what's happening to us, we come to Sesshin and then we come back. But even so, you know, sometimes we forget. You know, so I can remember, you know, my first Sesshins were quite difficult for me physically. And, you know, around day two of every Sesshin for a number of years, you know, I would begin to have fantasies about jumping in my car and driving away. And then, you know, around day three or so, something would happen and I would fall into that big mind, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, oh yeah, I forgot about this, right? You know, we live our lives on a very superficial level. You know, we live most of our lives, if you think of your mind as layered, you know, we live a lot of our lives on the top couple of layers of our mind. And, you know, and we have to, right? I mean, we have to make a living. We have to, you know, you have to be able to add and subtract. You have to be able to, you know, do what you did you have to know how to fill in your income taxes if you do your own income taxes. You need to have a job. You need to, you know, those things are essential. And you need to have a good discriminating mind, right? I mean, it's actually very good to be educated. It's good to be knowledgeable, informed. All of those are positive, right? So there's definitely a plus to being an educated, intelligent person, to knowing a lot, to being competent and skillful, and so on. But, you know, there are other parts of the mind that are very, very important, really, in certain ways, much more important than that. You know, at the end of your life, I don't think, you know, I think what's going to matter most is whether you acted from your, in Asian tradition, there's this word sheen. It means heart and mind, You know, in our Western tradition, we say head and heart, right? So somebody will say, oh, you're thinking with your heart, you need to think with your head. We divide the two. We, you know, there's feelings and there's intellect, right? Those are, and you know, and often we feel that it's dangerous to let your feelings, we say, don't let your feelings, let your emotions run away with you. The idea is your emotions are running away with you and you have to use your intellect to bring them to heal, right? To bring them under control. And this way of thinking goes back long, long. This is like an old Western way of thinking about the self. But, you know, Chinese people and people in India never thought that way. The word sheen means heart and mind, right? So, and actually in India too, the word hridya, which is like heart sutra, hridya isn't really mind. The word for mind is like citta or citta, like bodhicitta. Hridya means something like a deeper intelligence. So, you know, I went to Sesshin because I was in emotional distress, my small mind was saying, this is really too much. But around day three, something was activated in me that I didn't have a word for. And in Zen, we call it big mind. You know, when you are in a thoughtless state, around day three of Sesshin, you're going to enter a thoughtless state. It's like where the space between your ears is empty or dark. It's like your head is a block of wood, right? That's how it feels, right? The great Japanese Buddhist scholar D.T. Suzuki, his Dharma name was Daitetsu, means a blockhead. And in Zen, you know, if you are in Zen circles and you say his Dharma name is blockhead, people, oh, really? Now that's very impressive. He must be a very formidable person. In other words, you can enter that deep, empty state. He must have spent a lot of time in that deep, empty state for his teacher, Shoyin Shaku, to have given him such an exceptional name. So around day three, you know, we stumble into this blank mind, this, you know, where between your ears there's just nothing, or there's a block of wood. And this is like becoming a different kind of person. You couldn't even call it a human being. But it's that kind of person is activated in a very different way from the ordinary person, right? Now we're acting from a deeper place where I would say heart and head are not separated. The good news is that it's not just the case that deep mind is there. It's there. It's not just the case, though, that it's there. It's also active. So, you know, one way to think about ourselves is that we're sitting on the cushion and we're trying to get the big mind, and big mind is waiting there for us, right? But actually that's a rather false picture, although that's how it seems. Because all the time we're trying to get to big mind is trying to get to us. You know, so the big mind is constantly trying to break through all of these layers of fear and attachment and anger and shame, and, you know, and it's trying to liberate us while we're working on the other side. And, you know, we discover its presence, you know, sometimes by accident. You know, and in Zen we discover its presence around day three of Sesshin, you know, where the small mind is thinking, you know, where are the car keys, and I can't do this anymore. And then suddenly, it's like somebody switches, switches a light on in your head, but it really switches the light off in your head. And suddenly, you're in this dark state, which is actually the way your deeper self manifests itself to you. So, you know, the small mind is full of ideas and images and all kinds of notions. And when you get to the door of the big mind, it's blank and dark. And to the small mind, the big mind always looks blank and dark. But when you make contact with your big mind, you're now accessing the world in a very different way. You know, it's as though we have like a protective layer over ourselves as we go through our daily lives, and we dare not take it off, right? But when you're in Sesshin and you're around day three and your head has become like a block of wood, these elements of yourself that have been closed off now become activated. And Zen training is about re-educating ourselves or deconditioning ourselves and rebuilding ourselves in a better way, you know, in a way that's less fearful, more alert, more compassionate, more generous. You know, it's like, you know, rebuilding the self or rebuilding our world, if that makes any sense. So there's a real process to Zen, and we're on day two right now, and the big mind doesn't seem to be necessarily accessible. There's just the mind of day two at Sesshin, which is, you know, you're sitting on your cushion, you're sweating like a pig, you're thinking, ring the bell, ring the bell, ring the bell, you know, and you're hanging on by the skin of your teeth, right? It's just like, just getting through every sit, it's like hanging on by the skin of your teeth. But that's kind of what it takes to get to big mind. It's like if we could all sit comfortably and it was climate controlled, and you'd never have the kind of pressure or adversity almost, right? That would force you into a deeper part of yourself. And this is not about hurting ourselves in any way. But it's just, you know, it's a little bit difficult to have your knee hurt for 8 hours a day. And when you sweep the pain away with your breath, you begin to drop down into that big mind. And by around day three, you really get into that place. And then, you know, it's like relearning how to live. So a lot of Zen practice is, first of all, encountering your big mind, and then learning how to trust your big mind. So, you know, the big mind is trying to help us all the time, but, you know, we're fearful, and we have all these habits, and, you know, we prefer sometimes our own unhappiness to the unknown, you know, to the unknown. But, you know, the big mind is here helping us all the time. It's like this dynamic unconscious. And a lot of Zen practice is just learning how to trust the wisdom of that mind. And we sort of put ourselves in a place where we need to be rescued, you know, if you want to put it that way. So, you know, Sesshin is like, you know, putting yourself in a dilemma or a predicament, right? You know, by around the evening of day two of Sesshin, you're in a predicament, right? Because you come here and you want to go through this process, but it's become very difficult. And you know, at some point around the beginning of day three or the end of day two, we reach the limits of our ability to act, right? It's like I'm at my limit. You know, my left leg has been bothering me for the last 8 hours, and I'm supposed to be focusing on my breath, but I'm at my limits. See, and so now we need to be rescued, you know, so to speak. And, you know, actually big mind is coming to your rescue. At some time tomorrow is probably going to be the case that you will enter that blank mind in a deeper way. And it doesn't mean the pain in your leg will go away, but you'll definitely have a different relationship to the pain in your leg. And you know, Zen, one way to understand Zen is putting yourself into a position where you need to be rescued over and over again. Right? And every time we do it, we sort of hope that, we sort of doubt that big mind is going to show up, right? But it has been my experience that if you just trust the process, big mind will show up. You know, I'll never forget, you know, long ago, when I started teaching Zen, we used to have, sesshin at my house, believe it or not. And I think at one time we had the maximum we ever had was like 8 or it might have been even more, like 10 people. And this was the biggest sesshin I had ever run. It was 10 people, and I had not really done much teaching as a Zen teacher. And I remember, having high hopes for my sesshin. And around day two, everybody, and I hadn't really had this experience very often, so I didn't really know what was going on, but. You know, around day two, everybody was coming into the Dokusan room and going, I say, how's your sit? And they go, oh, terrible. It is terrible. You know, I feel like this is the dark night of the soul, you know. I don't know. This is just, I don't think I'll ever do, you know. It was like one after another. And I went to bed thinking, oh my God, as a Zen teacher, I'm a total failure. You know, and I obviously wasn't cut out to do this. And then, you know, we continued the sesshin, and then the next night, it was like, people would come in our house and go, oh, great, wonderful, same person, right, wonderful. You know, and they'd say, oh, I realize now, I didn't do that, right? It wasn't anything I did. I'm just the facilitator. It was big mind coming to the rescue, see. So this process is complicated. There's multiple stages to it. And we're sort of putting ourselves in a predicament. And putting yourself in a predicament requires trust. You have to trust the process. And, you know, it's often the case around day two of sesshin, people are sitting there thinking, you know, why did I do this? I don't think I'm up to this. And then, you know, then big mind often puts in an appearance. And it's a qualitatively different way of experiencing the world. It doesn't necessarily announce itself as big mind. But you suddenly notice you're, you know, between your ears as a big block of wood. And you're processing information differently. It's like between the sound and that emptiness, there's nothing intervening. See, so the little self that says, I like this or I don't like this is now quiet. And between your big mind and the sound of the bird, there's nothing in the way. And so, you know, when you hear the sound of the bird, you're 100% bird, 100% sound. This condition is something people don't necessarily recognize at first, but eventually it will be very familiar to you. So yesterday I was talking about the fact that Zen is not just about being serene or being calm or even being like a joyful, right? This koan is... it doesn't make much sense at first, but let me go over it again. A monk asked Haryo, what is the Dai-bai school? Haryo said, snow in a silver bowl. Well, you know, yesterday was so hot. Maybe that was another factor that, you know, another thing to contend with, right? You know, it's my legs hurt, I'm tired, and it's hot. You know, no matter what you're doing, even if you stand in front of a fan, it's still hot, right? And you might think there's no way out of this, right? But, you know, actually, at the core of your being is this enlightened mind, which is trying to help you wake up. And we play a little game with that, that enlightened mind. We put ourselves in a predicament, and then we say, come and rescue me. See? And the big mind, if you put yourself in a predicament, the big mind will come and rescue you. And the big mind never gets tired of playing this game, right? You know, it's like, here I am again. My legs are hurting. Help me. And the big mind will come and help you. And, you know, when the big mind comes to help you, it's like, you know, when the Buddha talked about his path, or when he talked about enlightenment, he always used the metaphor of coldness or coolness. And you know, in the West, because we think of human kindness as warmth, you know, this doesn't make any sense. It's like, why would the Buddha describe himself as cold? So he's like emotionally cold? Because, you know, all the accounts of the Buddha, by all accounts, he was a very, very engaging person. People who, when the Buddha died, one of his disciples was talking about what it was about the Buddha that was so special. And, you know, he said it was really the personal relationship, you know. It was the personal, he had, there was something about his relationship with you. This is really true. This is in the Pali Sutras. He said it was the personal relationship he had with every one of his students that made us trust him. So, you know, so the Buddha's very a warm and supportive person, apparently. So why would they describe him as cold? Why cold? Cool or cold? And then you remember, you know, yesterday in India, that would be considered a cool day. It was like 120 in India this summer. You know, so when the Buddha says, you know, a cold is a symbol, you know, when it's relentlessly hot, you know, it's unbearably hot, you know, suddenly this coldness opens up inside you, right? It's like that's this blockhead mind, right? Suddenly you're cool, calm. So, you know, a bowl of snow in a silver bowl is a symbol of like release, right? Release. You know, I'm burning up with fear. I'm burning up with shame. I'm burning up with disappointment. I'm burning up with, you know, and it's like suddenly, you know, inside yourself, there's this, suddenly this great coolness. It's like on a hot day, somebody handing you a bowl of snow. It's like it's suddenly your mind, you become still and calm. So you know, our own lineage, this is called the cold mountain, and in Chinese poetry and Chinese Zen literature too, cold is associated with cold represents the encounter with something that is beyond understanding, something that is beyond understanding. There's an intelligence beyond understanding, and that cold is symbolizing that, you know. And when you put yourself in a desperate situation and you call on big mind to rescue you, when it rescues you, you're cool, or you're taken to a place beyond understanding. See, so that blank mind is beyond understanding. And we Zen people develop a trust in that we will be rescued, basically. You know, people always think of Zen as like a tradition that's about toughness. You know, and you'll meet people in the Zen world who don't have a clue, if I may say so, about what Zen is, right? And they really think Zen is about discipline, or Zen is about, you know, toughing it out, don't be a wimp, or this kind of thing. And those people are clueless. You know, a great Zen master once said, when somebody said, what is the essence of Buddhism? He said, tender-heartedness. So, you know, when you are in contact with your true nature, you're cool and calm, and you are tender-hearted. And we Zen people are so trusting in that, so trusting in the big mind. We have put ourselves in predicaments again and again, and big mind has come to help us, that we are not afraid to put ourselves in difficult predicaments, right? So, you know, the Zen as we practice it here is about, we could call it, we shouldn't call these koans, we should call them predicaments. You know, so here's a predicament for you. Get caught up in this for a while and let big mind rescue you. Here's a predicament for you. Try to get out of this one, right? And when you fail to get out of this one, big mind is going to come to your rescue. So this is the secret of Zen, right? If you think Zen is about being tough, you're a million miles from it. You know, Zen is not about suffering or being in pain. It's about, you know, being willing to reach the limits of your power as an individual in order to encounter the part of yourself we normally conceal from ourselves, the part that's incomprehensibly vast. And so that's the method of Zen. That's what koans are really all about. And you know, this stuff in the koan here about, the koan is saying, look, no matter how hot it feels right now, the universe is preparing a bowl of snow for you in just a moment. And this business about the die-by schools, what's that all about, see? Well, yesterday I mentioned that Zen is not about being tranquil. It's not about trying to calm yourself. So let's say you didn't get a raise. You know, your boss, it's the end of the year, and your boss has assessed your performance, and you've worked your ass off, and you've done some of your best work. And then, you know, you get your performance assessment, and it says, well, he wasn't up to speed this year. And so you don't get your raise. And you know that's wrong. You know, my uncle, my father's, my second cousin, I guess, my uncle, I called him my uncle, Uncle Paul, was a creative artist, a commercial artist in New York. And when I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be a commercial artist for a while. And then Paul said, well, draw some things and let me take a look. And so I drew a bunch of stuff. And he said, you know, I think you should think of a better career. And he was right. I'm so glad I didn't pursue that. But he was a pretty successful commercial artist. But he said, you know, he would go to like a Mad Men, if you've ever seen the show Mad Men. You know, that's a fantasy, right? I mean, he would go and meet these people, these clients. And he would pull out stuff that he thought was his best work. And they'd just push it aside. And he'd have put something in the portfolio that was just to fill it up, you know, something he thought wasn't a very good idea. They'd love this. And you know, he would try to say, but don't you think? And they, no, we don't want that. This is the one, you know. So, that happens all the time. And you can go home and let that eat you up, right? You let that eat you up. And intellectually, you know that's not fair, and you know that's not right. But, if Zen was just about making you feel better, it wouldn't really be helpful. So if you're in emotional distress because you didn't get the raise or you didn't get the bonus at the end of the year, if Zen could somehow, you could sit down on the cushion and feel better, right? That wouldn't be much different from like a drug, right? Just like a tranquilizer. But the real question is, why am I having this response? You know, why have, and that's complicated, right? Why have I given this boss so much power? Yes, he has the power to give me a raise or not. But why have I given him power over who I am? Why have I given him the power to define who I am? Why have I done that? See? So, you know, that's the kind of question Zen wants you to get at, right? But you can't reason your way into that insight. This is like nobody can be his own therapist, right? Because we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what we've concealed from ourselves, right? So you know, the method of Zen is to go into blank mind, and then we internalize a koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And you sit with that koan, and you don't know what the hell this is about, but it's taking you somewhere. See, and maybe at some point as you're working with the koan, you have this tremendous sense of bereavement. And you remember, you know, my father never thought I was going to be any good at anything, you know. And so you sit with your pain for a long time, but eventually that memory stops triggering conditional responses, right? And you enter that blankness, and, you know, eventually there's a bowl of snow waiting for you, right? That's working through your obstacle. And we keep working through our obstacles, and little by little we become a very different kind of person. But we have to be willing to put ourselves in a predicament, you know, just a crude predicament, like pain in our legs, and a more refined predicament, like koan, right? So you have to be willing to put yourself there, and you only do that if you trust the process. And at first, you know, who trusts the process? But eventually people learn how to trust the process. I don't know where this koan is taking me, but I'm along for the ride. And then, you know, something explodes that hurts a lot, and you say, okay, well, I've been here before. I'm just going to keep going back into that blankness and saying, staff, staff, staff. And pretty soon, something completely different presents itself. It's like you've been looking at, you've been looking at this scene for 50 years and you've not seen something in the corner that makes all the difference in the world. And now you see it, and it's a totally different vista. Well, that's a little bit like the way koans work. So the Daibai school is not afraid of predicaments. It's not afraid to ask questions. It's about really like asking questions, but in a special way. It's not intellectually asking questions. It's by asking our big mind to show us the questions that really matter to us, right? And the big mind is happy to help if we trust it. Clouds gather over the great plains, but the universe can still be discerned. In other words, you know, we've all been in those clouds, I can't see a thing. I have no idea what the hell is up. Snow covers the flowering reeds, and it is difficult to distinguish them. Speaking of the coldness of it, it is, but, you know, there's something inside you that's colder than frozen snow and finer than powdered rice. See, there's a wisdom inside of you that we learn how to trust by putting ourselves in predicaments, because the big mind will never let us down. And when we trust the big mind, we activate the sheen, the vridya. To live a life in harmony with the sheen, with heart-mind, is to trust this big mind we have. A monk asked Hariyo, what is the Daiba school? See, Hariyo said, snow in a silver bowl, not afraid to investigate. See, Zen's about investigating. Not afraid of contradictions. We're not afraid of contradictions. We're not afraid of predicaments. Secho's verse, remarkable. The old man of Shinkai Temple, that's the founder of the Daiba school. His Indian name is Kanadeva. It was well said, snow in a silver bowl. The 96 can learn from themselves what it means. If they cannot, let them ask the moon and the sky. So when you're stuck, ask your big mind. Go into deep mushin. Daiba school, scarlet banners flapping, the wind is cool. Here comes the cool breeze. It's on the way to help you. Always.